Lecture 3. I will be beginning by talking a bit about the use of expressive lighting effects and how that has been discussed in cognitive film theory. Then I will say something about the sort of the links between the use of this kind of effects and the beginnings of directors claiming the status of artists. And finally, I'm gonna look at some examples from sort of beyond the Danish cinema, because a lot of the trends that I'll be talking about were ideas that were explored in other cinemas as well. Now, yesterday we looked briefly at a scene from The Candle and the Moth, Evangeliemandens liv, and I'm gonna show you another scene from the same film. This occurs sort of a little earlier than what you saw yesterday, where the hero is convicted of a crime. He's convicted of having killed a woman, and we will see him interact with her in the clip that that appears here. This will also feature a number of the effects that we discussed yesterday. So here we have an aperture being opened in the back, allowing for sort of a foreground and background interplay, and the people will sort of move into this chambre séparée. And up in the corner you can see there is a mirror that reflects what goes on within this small room. And it won't be used for the kinds of dramatic effects that we saw some examples of yesterday, but just to sort of open up the space and give a sense of the room sort of continuing beyond the edges of the frame. Again, we have two rooms, one visible through an aperture in the background. Thank you. So we have this aperture in the background and being used to create this rather remarkable silhouette effect. What does the movie get out of using this silhouette effect? Anyone want to comment on that? What's the effect on the spectator of having an effect like that? How does it work? What does it do?
Erotic
atmosphere. Atmosphere? What kind of atmosphere?
Erotic.
What?
Erotic
atmosphere.
Yes.
Okay. How? I mean, that's obviously true. The situation is an erotic one. We have a woman taking off her clothes, which, you know, you don't really sort of need, and you could say that the eroticism lies in that rather than in the silhouette effect. I think you're right, but maybe we can get a little closer to it. Anyone else? The mystery, yes. There is in the scene as it plays out here, of course, the sort of the seductive performance that the woman carries out for the hero is sort of doubled and becomes a seductive performance for us as well. And there is, of course, this sort of tantalizing interplay between what we see and what we don't see. And I think that in many places it would not have been allowed to sort of to show the woman removing her clothes so that we would be able to see it. And by allowing us to observe it only indirectly, I think that the film allows us to get a pretty good idea of what is going on without provoking the ire of the censors to quite the same degree, which is, of course, sort of a practical consideration, but I think that we can maybe leave it at that. But maybe we can return to it a little bit later on, because I think that there are some points we could raise that will sort of get us a bit closer to explaining why this sort of creates an atmosphere of eroticism and mystery. Okay. It also, the sequence also uses directed light, and that's something that we saw even in 1911 in the Pfingstens Port. We have this this room that's largely in darkness, and then we have sort of a single a light source that illuminates part of the action, and because of the way the mirror is set up, the light sort of is also able invisibly to illuminate something that goes on beyond the right side of the screen. Of course, here this use of light is motivated by the fact that it's what's going on is taking place at night, but arguably it's still something that also has and effects on on the atmosphere, the mood that is created by the scene. A further example is another film from 1916, also directed by Holger Madsen. It's sort of a crime film. It's called The Soul Thief, and it's about an evil doctor who's sort of a master criminal and who uses, who hypnotizes innocent people to steal valuable stuff for him. This nobleman has this very valuable jewelry, and the evil doctor has hypnotized the nobleman's daughter to, in an attempt to steal the jewels. Fortunately, the nobleman has called in a detective who will help solve the mystery. Here we have the detective. And again, we have sort of a room laid out in depth, and we have a servant moving into the background and then changing the configuration of the room by drawing the curtain, and in that way concentrating our attention on what goes on in the foreground. Here we have another mirror, appropriate for a lady's bedroom, but nevertheless, it also functions to enlarge the space in a similar way to what we saw in the other example just before. Again, we have a change in tinting that underscores the shift from light to darkness. This probably wasn't a freeze frame, but I think that this is something that was put in because as part of the restoration process. And there probably was a shot there of the doctor, but it had been decomposed too much to be used. So we have the hypnotized woman moving from the background towards the foreground, and her white dress catches the light. But before she can reach the cabinet with the jewels, which is over by the window, she is intercepted. So we have these quite dramatic light effects with light from restricted sources falling into dark rooms and creating very sort of strong differences between the highlight areas and the rest of the rooms, which remain shrouded in shadow. Are there other kinds of films where we see those sorts of effects? Does it remind you of anything else?
Horror movies.
Okay. Any particular sort or particular historical period or anything like that?
German expressionism.
Yeah. Okay.
Film noir.
German expressionism and film noir are certainly sort of two schools of film that are often associated with these kinds of effects, and the Danish films have even been Danish films using these kinds of effects have been used by critics attacking the work of Siegfried Krakauer in his book From Caligari to Hitler, because in From Caligari to Hitler he argues for a sort of a sociological explanation of German expressionism, arguing that it's connected to sort of trends and habits of social psychology that were particular to Germany, and the critique then runs, well, that can't really be true because, you know, look at the Danish films and they're doing much the same, but I think that there are problems with that, and again this sort of brings us back to sort of the problem of influence that we were talking about yesterday, and it sort of makes the Danish films and the other films from the same period that used this kinds of effects into sort of precursors of expressionism films that do the same only not quite as well. And I think that there are problems with that idea, and that there are a number of other sort of factors that went into sort of creating the particular visual style of German expressionism from 1920 onward. But I mean, there are you could say that there are similarities. Certainly, there are a number of mad doctors who hypnotize people and urge them to do crimes and so on, but again that's sort of a common and widespread motif at this time, and it's also looking at it in those terms tends to sort of to emphasize the historical contingency of these kinds of devices, and sort of suggesting that they are in a sense that they're more shaped by a particular historical environment than more sort of long-term needs in spectators. And this is what the sort of the cognitive film theory that Torben Brodahl is a representative of has criticized. And I mean, if we sort of move back and look at this in very, very broad terms, we can say that there is a sort of a very important trend within film theory and theoretical and theoretical thought in other areas of the humanities as well, that's strongly influenced by semiotics. And semiotics grew out of linguistics, and so the paradigm for semiotic inquiry is language, and that's sort of the model of even when sort of it turns its attention to other parts of human human existence and human life, the sort of the model for the stuff that's being investigated is still language. And another sort of very important aspect of this is the arbitrariness of language. So, you know, we have this animal which is called dog in English and hund in Danish and pish in Czech, and you know these words are quite different from each other, but they all refer to the same animal. And there aren't any of the words, arguably, which is any more or less organically created to the animal than any other. It's simply arbitrary. There is no link there. And and that means that when you sort of project that onto other cultural realms, it tends to emphasize sort of the split between a representation and whatever it is a representation of. So the split between a real dog and a picture of a dog. And again, when you transfer this to picture theory or to film theory, it tends in the direction of being questioning towards realism, and to suggest that because there is this gap between the representation and what it is a representation of, you can never, the representation is something fundamentally different from the real thing, and you can never really sort of cross that gap. So sort of pursuing a representation that you want to be real is a chimera. It's a fool's errand. It's something that can never be accomplished. And from that you get towards the sort of the connected idea that if you still insist on connecting representation with reality, you're denying the existence of this gap. And why would you do that? Well, maybe you're trying to trick someone. Maybe there is, you have some sort of agenda that makes you sort of try to erase this split. Maybe you're trying to sort of convince people that something that you've made up is actually reality, and in that way impress false ideas on people. And so from this sort of assumption of the gap between the representation and the reality, you sort of quite easily get to a point of sort of a fundamental suspicion towards particularly realistic representation, because in a sense a representation that calls attention to itself as a representation is less suspect, because it acknowledges the existence of this gap. And of course this idea has been a very influential one, and a very productive one in many contexts, but it does have this sort of skew in and sort of or anti-realistic direction. And cognitive film theory, in a sense, is coming from the opposite direction. One could say that cognitive film theory, I mean, where semiotics sort of uses language as sort of the fundamental model for understanding all kinds of cultural products and representations and so on. Cognitive theory, film theory, begins from visual perception, and particularly the visual perception of the real world. The work of the American psychologist James Gibson has been very, very influential in sort of forming the development of cognitive film theory, and where sort of semiotics sort of emphasizes that the words we use and the real things are two sort of completely different things. Study of visual perception headed by Gibson is all about how visual perception connects up with our interaction with the real world. There is a strong influence in this from evolutionary thinking, and so the sort of a very important part of this kind of consideration is how does how can we understand these features of human visual perception as something that is the result of evolution, because that's sort of the fundamental assumption, that the kind of visual apparatus that we have is something that is the result of human evolution, and for that reason it must be something that has contributed to the survival of our ancestors, that again means that it must be something that's useful, that helps us somehow in engaging with the world, in surviving its dangers, and passing on our traits to our descendants. So that's sort of a strong feature of this. Now, Gibson's thinking was sort of molded by his experiences in World War II, where he investigated how the world looked to pilots trying to land their planes, and how the landing of planes could be made less dangerous by understanding how that worked. And so sort of the image of the runway, in a sense, is central to Gibsonian thinking. And Gibson's idea was that that the world provides us with certain cues. He called them affordances that we can act on directly, that we don't need to interpret, that they're not signs, but rather that they directly enable us to move through the world and interact with it in a way that's useful to our survival. And so, in a sense, various features of the human perceptual apparatus that we sort of perceive converging lines moving into the distance as a road that we can follow, that we interpret the occlusion of objects by other objects as indicative of which ones are near and which ones are further away, and other aspects of human perception are that help us understand and act directly on the world. And another thing that he was very interested in was the way that we, even though the sort of the array of impressions that hits our eyes is filled with all sorts of change and variation, our minds are to some extent able to correct for this, so that even though, for instance, by sort of various objective physical measures, colors will change quite radically if you change the illumination when you move around. If a person moves from light to shade and back out again, sort of the visual array will change very significantly. But that's not how we perceive it. We perceive the same person moving along, still wearing the same green jersey and blue trousers, and this is something that our a sort of order that our mind imposes on the array in front of us. Now, how is all this relevant to film history at all? Well, the point of this is that it does. If you accept, and I mean there is evidence for some, not all of this, but it's certainly something that the psychologists have been working quite intently on for a number of years. It does suggest that the way that our visual perception system works is non-arbitrary, that it has certain features, certain preferences, and that it sort of tries to extract information from the environment in a way that helps us negotiate it successfully and survive it. And so that our visual perception system tends to be correct. And the sort of basic assumption of cognitive film theory then is that we use the same visual perception system to process film as we do other things, because it would not really make sense to suggest that we have some sort of separate visual apparatus to process moving images. I mean, they've only been around for 120 years, so we can't really assume that evolution has sort of come up with a new system for that. That would be impossible. But So basically, moving images are like the real world, and they perceive them in basic ways, in ways that are quite similar to our perception of the real world. And that, of course, means that sort of conversely from a semiotic approach, this would sort of suggest that we have actually a kind of bias in the direction of realism, that we're sort of more predisposed to accept stuff that is similar to reality and to treat that as genuine, then we are disposed to sort of look at things that is sort of somehow strikingly different from reality. And in Torben Grodal's article Film, Lighting and Mood, he sort of takes this way of thinking and applies it specifically to film lighting, and suggests that film light the film light obviously has a number of differences from the way that the real world is lit, but that our experience of it is significantly molded by our sort of real world expectations, so that we tend to look at prefer to extract as much visual information as possible from the environment. So we sort of tend to take a reasonably well illuminated scene as our baseline. And so if we get illumination that varies radically from that, it becomes sort of a special case, and that sort of encourages us to explain it in other ways and see it as different. So these kinds of harsh sidelights that you have here, in a sense, produce a double effect. On the one hand, Grodal suggests because of the way that our visual system will sort of look for invariance, even though we can only here, for instance, we can't see the arm of the detective. It's disappeared into the shadow, but we assume that it's still there because there isn't. We assume that objects in that way are constant and invariant across time. And even though we can't see half the evil doctor's face, we still assume that it's. That it's there. So, in a sense, we bring a simulation of what the complete world would look like, or we mentally create it when we are faced with images like these, where we only see part of the represented world, where the rest is shrouded in darkness. But on the other hand, we also still get we experience these sort of darkness shrouded images directly and as such, and so there is a gap between sort of the underlying mental model of what of what this world must be like and what we actually see. And Godel then suggests that this sort of gap is part of what creates creates atmosphere, and that this atmosphere, this mood, can be that it will sort of tend in different directions depending on the narrative context of the images, but that it's not something that's completely arbitrary. It's something that is connected with the way that the images appear. So, for instance, when you have this these effects, these large areas of darkness, you can't see as much, and it becomes more difficult to interact with the environment, or even to sort of mentally simulate interacting with the environment, to sort of vicariously to put yourself in the place of the character and to imagine what could they do. Well, it's that's less clear because you can't really see the room, you can't really see how they could move about. And so this this suggests that a lot of darkness is connected with a reduction in control, with less possibility of doing specific things. And then the sort of the emotional valence of this can then be contextualized in different ways, so that if sort of the context is a romantic one, then the surrender of control can be something that's experienced as pleasant. But in a situation like this, where you're dealing with suspense and evil doctors and even sort of mental control from a distance, it's much more in the direction of the horrific, the connection between darkness and the horrific isn't just that in the dark monsters can hide and so on, but also that there is this kind of reduction in the possibilities of action. And further, one can suggest that this is also something which which can be linked. I think. Let me just wait a moment with Benjamin Christensen here. Go back to this one. This kind of deviation that you get with images like these is also something that can be experienced as connected to subjectivity, so that these kinds of divergent lighting schemes can be experienced as expressive not just of of the mood of the horrific or perhaps the romantic, but also to a connected experience, in some cases an experience had by the character. And of course, in suspense films and horrific films, we quite often have characters who react to the dark with fear, or even in some cases sort of project their fears into it. And this film here, let me just get the other example. Sjæletyven, this is a later 1 o'clock, and we have the heroine asleep, and behind her is a pool of darkness, and from that darkness a vision of the evil doctor exerting his hypnotic mental control on her emerges. And this is done through double exposure. You can see that there is a bit of overlap there on the covers. But basically, here in sort of a very an unusually explicit way, her what's the stuff that's going on inside her head is projected into the darkness surrounding her. But in some ways, this by using these kinds of devices expressively, they may not just express the feelings of the characters, but one can relatively easily move in the direction of thinking of them as expressive of the vision of an artist as well. And so I think that it's quite interesting that when we see filmmakers who begin to think of themselves as artists, and this is something that begins to come up right around this time, and explicitly sort of frame themselves as artists. Many of them are directors who very precisely are interested in exploring these kinds of expressive devices. And sort of a very clear case of that is Benjamin Christensen, who had started out. He originally trained as an opera singer, but he suffered from a nervous condition that made him lose his voice when he was on stage. And then he tried as a regular actor. He was also trained as an actor, and he went to the same acting class at the Royal Theatre as Asta Nielsen and Paul Reumert. Quite a small community, but his nervous condition persisted, and so he turned to becoming a champagne salesman. And after he'd been that for a while, one of his friends got him interested in appearing in movies where he didn't need to use his voice. And we saw the still from the lost film Skæbnebilledet yesterday, where he was standing with his violin. And that was one of a number of films where he appeared as an actor for one of the smaller film companies. But the company ran into trouble, and Christensen convinced them to let him try his hand at directing. And the result was Det hemmelighedsfulde X, The Mysterious X, a spy thriller which came out in the spring of 1914 and which had been produced with a very long production schedule for the time to allow for unusual care with the filming and particularly the lighting, as we shall see in this sequence from early in the film. At midnight, two suspicious characters approach the old mill. So Christensen uses other similar effects throughout the movie, and used that in his promotion of the film to underscore that what he had done there was something different, and that it was significantly something that he had come up with, something that showed his artistry in making the movie. And this becomes even more pronounced when we get to his next film, Hilton's Net, Night of Revenge, it means, which came out in 1916. It was called Blind Justice in English. But the film features a prologue where we see Christensen along with the lead actress examining a model of the house where much of the action takes place. So in a sense, he puts himself and his activity as a director into the film. The promotion sort of also underscored his contribution. He, after the success of Det Hemmelighedsfulde X, he had the film company renamed as Benjamin Christensen Film. And the poster here, it says, written by Benjamin Christensen, directed by Benjamin Christensen, in the leading role, Benjamin Christensen. So here we have no doubt that we should think of Christensen as the mastermind behind the movie, during the story he ages considerably. So here we have him in the role of strong Henry as a young man, as an older man, and here we have his face without any of the makeup. So that's the face of the director, and all of this to emphasize that he was sort of the genius behind all of this. And this was by no means an obvious way of thinking. I mean, today we've sort of for long been working under the assumptions of auteurism and so on, and the idea of the director as sort of the presiding, the most important creative force behind a film is one that is widespread and supported by many institutions. But in this period, this wasn't obvious at all. And in many cases, or in the minds of many, sort of the most obvious analog to understanding what the cinema was the theater. And of course, in the theater, the tendency is to see not the stage director, but the playwright as sort of the most important creative figure. And that it's whoever wrote the words who is the most significant figure. And so especially since with the development of the long feature drama, films became in a sense more like plays, it would seem it seemed obvious to many that films were quite similar to plays, that they were really, I mean, in the minds of some, they were just like recordings of plays, like you would put up a phonograph and record a musical performance. You could put up a camera and record a theatrical performance. Of course, you'd miss the words, which many consider to be the most important part of the theatrical performance. But nevertheless, that was something that were terms that a lot of people thinking about the cinema used. And so even though one might sort of acknowledge that the film had certain important differences from the stage, one could still take the attitude that sort of the most important creative figure was whoever came up with the story, rather than the one who directed the actors and arranged for the camera, that the writer rather than the director was the key figure. And in some ways the German Autoren film was based on that premise, that if you hired sort of real writers to make the films, then you would get film art, because the most important thing was the script. But Christensen marks sort of another approach, and he insists that or his work is shows that he considered the director to be sort of the key figure. Now, of course, in his case, he also wrote his own scripts, and he thought that that was what a proper filmmaker should do, that he should develop his own stories and then visualize them, and that it should be sort of a complete process undertaken by one and the same figure. But nevertheless, this was something that was this was an idea that was beginning to gain more and more ground, and that at least some film companies started thinking about the importance of the director in a different way from what had been the case just a few years previously, that the directors were not simply functionaries, but that their work had a key role in deciding whether you had strong, successful films or not. And as we shall see in the next lecture, this was something that the big Swedish company, Svenska Bio, took seriously at a relatively early point. But but Christensen had sort of started out along the same way before that. And Hævnsnat, again, is like De Hemmelighedsfulde X, is sort of it's not a really sort of deep story. It's kind of a murder mystery, and Christensen plays a man who has been innocently convicted of murder. There are shades of Les Misérables in the story, and there had been a big French adaptation of Les Misérables in 1912, which was in four parts, but when screened together, it was almost 4 hours in length, and directed by Albert Capellani. This film was shown in Copenhagen, and Christensen later talked about how that was that really made a very strong impression on him. So if one sort of sees elements of Les Misérables in the story of Hævnsnat, that's not really surprising. Now, Christensen's figure in the clip I'll be showing you here is a convicted murderer, and he's escaped from prison, and he's seeking shelter from the snowstorm. He has his infant son with him, and he's obviously he's innocent of the crime he's been convicted of, but no one believes him. And in the house, in the big house, people are worried about this criminal being on the loose, but they are not yet aware that he has actually already gained access to the building. The door shut with string, and now we get an amazing keyhole shot. So Christensen worked only intermittently, unlike many directors from this period, who would usually make lots of films in a given year. He only made these two pictures before 1920. Another project was aborted because of the outbreak of the First World War. But then, from 1919 to 1921, he spent 2 years on this really extremely elaborate film, which was financed by Svenska Bio, the Swedish company, but largely shot in Denmark, which was sort of a documentary, you might even call it, about the witchcraft persecutions in the late Middle Ages and the early modern period. And it starts out as sort of an illustrated lecture, and you see pictures from old books and little models that illustrate ancient cosmologies and so on. But after 10 minutes or so, you start getting reenactments, and most of the film consists of these really very flavorful reenactments the course of witchcraft superstitions, I'll show you some of that later on. But what I wanted to emphasize here was the way that he starts the film. With his own face. Instead of sort of ordinary credits, he thanks his main collaborators, his cinematographer and his set designer, using "I" in the intertitles to make very clear that this is indeed his work. Okay. There we go. In Germany, as I mentioned, you get a somewhat different development, and there you have the Autorenfilm. In Germany, like in Denmark and elsewhere, star vehicles were very important. Asta Nielsen was the biggest star in Germany, and the German star Henny Porten joined her, and in a sense that sort of cemented the same kind of perception that films could be art, to the extent that they had artists, that is, star actors from the legitimate theater in the main roles. But then also there was the Autorenfilm, and of course we talked about yesterday about Atlantis and how that was sort of devised to fit into this German category. But sort of the most, probably best known German Autorenfilm was Der Student von Prag, The Student of Prague, from 1913, which was directed by a Dane, Stellan Ryge, who had been a stage director in the theater in Copenhagen, but got caught up in this big persecution of men who had purchased sexual services from young cadets from the Naval Military Academy, and was convicted of having had sexual relations with some of these young men, and was sent to prison for 3 months, and did not really sort of, I mean, that made made him feel very, very unwelcome in Copenhagen. So he moved to Berlin and started a new career there as a film director, and became quite quickly, in the course of just 1 year, from 1913 to 1914, he directed at least 8 and possibly more films. Only 2 of these survives, and one survives only in a single print in Japan. He, when World War I broke out, he volunteered to fight in German uniform, and died from wounds before the year was out. So his career was nipped in the bud there. However, the film was, in a sense, seen more as the work, at least by contemporaries, of its author and its star. The poster emphasizes Paul Wegener, the actor who plays the leading role, or roles, it should be said, because it's the story about a young man who sells his mirror image to this Mephistopheles-like figure, and the mirror image then sort of takes on an independent existence and goes around and does all kinds of horrible things, ruining his engagement and killing people and taking all his money and basically ruining his life, and at the end he pulls out a gun and shoots his mirror image, and then he falls over dead himself. It takes place in the early 1800s and sort of very much fits in with the sort of the horror stories of German Romanticism, and takes those as its sort of model, but it's not directly based on any one tale, but is rather an original script by Hans-Heinz Evers, who was a relatively well-known writer of fantastic and horrific tales at the time. And the film is, I mean, the sort of the doubling, the double effects where you see two Paul Wegeners in the image at the same time are quite remarkably well done. And the film also uses dramatic lighting, particularly in this key scene where our hero is challenged to a game of cards by his evil double. Do you dare play with me? So, this film was remade in 1926, and some older film historians sometimes get the two mixed up. But you quite often, I mean, not in Thompson and Bordwell's film history, but in some other introductory film history books, you would see this film referred to quite often as a kind of precursor of expressionism, both because of the dramatic lighting in this scene, but also, of course, because of the supernatural motif and the rather strong similarity between the Mephistopheles figure, who's called Scapinelli, and the Caligari, the figure of Dr. Caligari from sort of the famous breakthrough expressionist film. However, I think that it's important to point out that this sequence here is described in Hans Heinz Ewers' original script, which survives, and it says there, "Die Beleuchtung vom oben." The scene should be lit from above, so dass man fast nur die Köpfe sieht, so that you see pretty much only the faces, wie auf ein altes Bild vom Rembrandt, like on an old painting by Rembrandt. So this isn't really something that sort of points forward towards something that doesn't exist yet. Rather, it's something that takes its inspiration from work that had already been done in the visual arts. And similarly, in the United States, during the same period, you have a director like Cecil B. DeMille, who works again very consciously with dramatic lighting in a number of films, using these same kinds of stark contrasts between light and dark. And this was sometimes referred to as Lasky lighting, because the films were produced by the Lasky Company, but DeMille himself also spoke of it as Rembrandt lighting. So in that sense, the use of chiaroscuro, of stark contrast between light and shadow in Rembrandt's paintings, was sort of an important model for film artists here. And one of the points that Grodel makes in his article is that this kind of lighting has something which is sort of necessarily artificial about it, because one of the effects that it has is to focus our attention very clearly on sort of the dramatically significant parts of the scene. And it's the light that does this, and the light sort of works as a pointer. Look at this, and of course it makes it easier to do that because all the rest of the image is dark. But in that means that the light behaves quite differently from the way that light behaves in the real world, because the naturally occurring light is not directed. It doesn't have any sort of narrative purpose. It doesn't point out particular parts of the world for our attention. And of course, this happens quite often in movies, that through highlighting of various kinds, particular parts of the image are indexed for our attention. But again, this sort of this gives an effect of artificiality, which may be. But which also can then sort of register as artistry, that this is something that shows the artistry of the filmmakers, and so in that way the use of dramatic highlighting is something that's in that way sort of closely connected with the sort of emergence of directors as artists.